Listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Grassroots, community supported, solar powered, awesome radio.
Are we the only solar powered in the state?
Only solar powered in the Midwest.
Really?
We are. Ah. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Beautiful day. Beautiful day. Not too hot. But we need to be careful. I just understand from a friend today that some trees are dying and we may need to water them.
Yes, that's a very good point. I think some of my trees were not doing too well, and they're getting watered today. And apparently when you water trees, you don't want to spray the trunks. You want to water the ground around the tree,
mm-hmm.
clear out as far
as the tree is tall.
As the tree, well, or as the branches
as a shade,
spread.
As a shade extends.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, as a shade extends, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, yeah, because that's where the root system is, I understand.
Right, right. So,
okay.
Yeah, I know that there's trees dying all over the country.
Yes, I know there are a lot of trees dying in Texas. Your brother has told me they've lost a lot of trees. That's so sad.
I know. So this is Writer's Voices, and last week, if you were with us, we had a really cool interview with Monty Schultz, the son of Charles Schultz. And one of the things that really impressed me about speaking with Monty is that, you know, he spoke very eloquently about his work and about he's a novelist and some fascinating novels that have been that he wrote as one book and then became three.
Yeah, right.
And then it's being put back together as one again. But he also spoke really about his father and his father's influence on him in a very loving and respectful way. They must have had a really wonderful relationship.
Of course,
his father was the creator of the Peanuts comic.
And I believe that the Peanuts cartoons are now beginning again from when they started because...
Oh, they're starting to run them from the beginning?
Yeah, I think so.
Like in order?
The drawings are different than they were... In later years, just a little bit. The character's a little bit different. You know, your dad carved some of those characters.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, he did. He carved Snoopy, and he carved Lucy.
Do you still have those?
Oh, yes, of course.
Wow. Great.
Yeah.
So while we're waiting for today's guest to arrive, who's on his way to the studio, live to the studio, which isn't common. Most of our guests we do by phone because they're not here in Iowa, but our guest today is here. But tell me a little bit about what you've been reading this week, Mom.
Well, this week I have been reading a religious book, basically, and trying to keep up with the newspaper, all the things going on, the earthquake in the east and the hurricane that's moving up, because I have friends out there. And, you know, everybody is being urged to evacuate. And for them, that's something new.
Oh, right. They don't live on the Gulf Coast where it happens all
right.
the time.
And did you know that the earthquake, the Washington Monument was damaged? And
yes, I yeah. did know that.
So that's kind of bad. I don't know how they ever built that in the first place, but to have it damaged is even worse.
Wow. So anyway, back to writing and writers' voices.
Yes.
And if you miss any shows, you can always find them later posted on KRUUFM.com or on writersvoices.com. We also have a number of contributing writers now who are writing for writersvoices.com. We have articles on getting published. We have articles on writing. We have tips on writing. We have book reviews. We're getting new material there all the time. So it's...
we're getting to be famous, aren't we?
Find something you like. And now it's time to welcome our guest for today, Andrew Edlin. Welcome to Writers' Voices.
Hi.
Hi.
Now, Andrew was born in Brighton, UK, currently lives in Fairfield, Iowa, and has recently published a book called Inaccessible Dragon Retreat, which I would characterize as a young adult novel, and which you can perhaps tell by the title might fit into the fantasy genre.
Fantasy, action, adventure, yes.
Yes. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Andrew, and tell us how you came to write about dragons.
Well, I've been writing for a long time on and off, but dragons, people tend to think, oh my goodness, not another dragon book. What can be new about dragon books? You know, I mean, hasn't it been done? Anne McCaffrey, Tolkien, you know. But the answer is, dragons are very interesting because there are legends about them from all over the world. They are probably the most pervasive fantasy creature, and that's because they're very interesting, and there are certain accepted traditions about the way dragons behave and their looks, and of course the breathing fire and all that sort of thing, that go right across books, and they get transferred from author to author as sort of accepted part of the canon, which makes them very interesting. So I just really decided to put a slightly different spin on dragons, a spin of my own, which, without reading the book, you can't really know what it is. But that's part of, you know, the one question that all authors hate is, well, what's your book about? To which I normally reply, well, if I could tell you that in a reply, I wouldn't bother writing it, really. So, but it's set in 1961
okay.
in England, and there are a certain number of dragons left in the world. They came into the world mostly in about 600 AD through a portal from another planet
mm-hmm.
in Turkey. And the reason that most people don't see them is because most of the time they are naturally invisible, unless they're digesting, in which case they become visible when they're digesting. So if you see a UFO, there's a good chance you're seeing a dragon where you can't see anything except its central torso, which happens to be rather oval, and that explains one of the mysteries one's been seeing. And in fact, young dragons have been known to tease humans by flying around in formation, half invisible, just for kicks. So
they okay. have that much control over their invisibility.
Some more than others, but yes. But part of the book is about the fact that they are losing their ability to become invisible, and that's putting them under severe threat. And that's one of the reasons that they tend to live in very inaccessible places.
Right.
And so one of the main dragon characters is living on Inaccessible Island, which is a real island.
Is it really called that?
Absolutely, and it's in the South Atlantic. It's part of the Tristan da Cunha group, which still belongs to the UK, and it is an interesting place. It is a long, long way from anywhere, and a good place for a dragon to hide.
Do people ever go there?
Occasionally. Nobody lives there. There was a group of school children from England that lived there for a month or two on a sort of extended field trip.
I thought you were going to say extended punishment.
It's a very formidable looking place. It's basically got these 1,000-foot-high volcanic cliffs on all four sides. And so it's inaccessible not only by its geographical location, but even trying to land on the island is not easy. So it just seemed a perfect place.
Now, the main sort of heroic human characters are Welsh.
Yes.
And are you Welsh?
I have Welsh background, yeah. I'm about a little over a quarter Welsh. Wales, of course, their flag is a dragon. So most people in England or in the United Kingdom would particularly associate Wales with dragons, and that's part of the reason why that made sense to set a lot of the action in Wales.
Now, some of these things about dragons that you've told us and some of the others in your book, like the ability to be invisible, are these part of the accepted canon of dragon lore, or is this unique to this story?
You will find in other books that I've read, and I certainly haven't read, you know, as extensively on dragons as you could. If you start searching on Amazon under dragons, then there's pages of dragon books. But I've read other books where dragons are invisible, but it's certainly not part of the accepted the major accepted features of dragons.
Which would be the ability to fly, breathe fire.
Right, the scales, the claws, the hypnotizing eyes. I mean, it's astonishing how universal these legends and stories are, and they're certainly not limited to the West or to our culture. You know, they're all over the place. There's certainly very extensive stories about Chinese dragons who in my book are considered to be fairly separate. They look very different. They're much thinner and, according to the story, arrived at a much earlier time on Earth.
And there's not much intermixing between...
Not so much, but as in the course of this book, there is more because of the circumstances.
Well, the Chinese dragon is used extensively in their dance,
right,
in their theater, and in their folklore.
Yes.
There was a part, unfortunately I've only had the book for a week, so I didn't get clear to the end, but I read most of it, and there was a section where a reporter is doing some research and so forth,
right,
and refers to a place in China that has a dragon festival, and they they block everything off and make sure no one from the outside can come
right
in. Is this true?
No. It's in Mongolia. I like to think
okay
it's true.
Could be.
But one of the fascinating things in all stories that touch on, strongly seen in Harry Potter, of course, is the fact where there's a sort of normal society and there's some secret that just a portion of the society are privy to, like the existence of dragons or whatever it may be. And so part of the essential narrative tension in the book is exactly that, is, you know, people that know about dragons, and they're obviously in a very small minority, and the majority of people don't, although they may well have seen things that are caused by dragons, but they don't realize that.
So what made you want to write an entire book about dragons?
Well, the exact event that triggered this thought was actually I was on vacation in Christmas 2000 in the Virgin Islands in St. Croix, and happened to see way, way away along the coastline, there were these really big birds. To this day, I have no idea what they were, over the cliffs. And they were probably 2 or 3 miles away, and they looked huge. And I don't know, if you look at a bird a long way away, it's often very hard to tell how large they are. But the illusion was that these things had a wingspan of about 10 or 12 feet.
Wow.
They didn't, I'm sure. I'm sure it was just, you know...
6 or 8.
You know, who knows? I mean, there's some big birds around. Mm-hmm. But it just set the idea in my mind of a somewhat isolated place where dragons could still exist and not be seen, but, you know, it's not enough for them just to be rare. There has to be another twist to make it that they're not seen, and therefore I came up with the idea of that they are inherently invisible because of their physiology, and that only breaks down either because there's something in our atmosphere now which is causing them to. And the suggestion is that might be radioactivity, which is only prevalent in the atmosphere of the Earth since the nuclear testing in the early 40s and beyond. Just of their very nature, that they have that. But it's now compromised either by that or, as I say, by having digested, which somehow overcomes their ability to be invisible.
Do I dare ask what it is they're digesting?
Oh, well, there's actually quite a lot about that in the book. The very first dragon we're introduced to eats quite a lot of shredded wheat, Mars bars, all kinds of human food.
Oh.
But normally they hunt. You know, they're carnivores. So
okay.
They'll, Higib, who's the dragon who lives on Inaccessible, lives on seals and seabirds and fish and whatever, although it takes quite a lot of fish to satisfy a dragon's appetite, especially an old one who is very large. They share with crocodiles the ability to get much bigger the older they are. So,
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
You know, if a crocodile keeps on living, it'll keep on growing.
Are there any other animals that do that?
I don't know, but I certainly know that's true of crocodiles. It may be true of reptiles as a whole. It seems to be true of snakes, I think, too.
Yeah.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah.
And so, you know, some of these dragons are 2,000 years old, or, you know, their sense of time is completely different from ours. So, yeah, they're pretty big.
Wow. Did you tell dragon stories to your children when they were young?
Oh, I don't know about dragon stories, but I told lots of stories. they may have featured somewhere along the line.
You've always been a storyteller.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And as I say, dragons are particularly fascinating. I mean, the whole story isn't about dragons. It's also very much about the humans that on the one hand are trying to protect them and on the other hand are trying to destroy them. So there's two opposing groups of humans, the protectors and the Order of St. George. One of the things I had fun with is in this book, St. George, who of course is the patron saint of England and is famous for having slain a dragon. Is a bad guy. And his successors in the order that he founded are also bad guys. They're dedicated to destroying the dragons, which I liked as a sort of twist on the normal way that he's viewed.
Wow. Your daughter, Holly,
yes.
Her name, I noticed on the Amazon site that you're listed as author, but her name is also on there and someone
else. As editor.
Else, as editor. Okay.
Because she contributed a great deal of the ideas. She was constantly my editor. You know, I would send her drafts. And so she was editing for content, for continuity, and also very, very simply for, you know, typos and that sort of thing. So, she was an enormous assistant as a collaborator on the story, and herself has always been very fond of dragon stories. And then when it came to the idea of putting it on Kindle as the easiest way to publish it, you obviously need to have a really striking book cover. And I was very lucky to collaborate there with Alicia Caradas, who's the art teacher at Washington Elementary and a very, very skilled artist. And she very quickly got the idea of what I wanted for the cover. And so the cover's rather fun, too.
So since this is a young adult book, you don't have to worry about illustrations that you would if it was a children's book.
That's true. You know, it's got no illustrations. I mean, it could have. I mean, it's conceivable you could put some illustrations into it, but they're certainly not necessary.
But use your imagination.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of Lord of the Rings has no illustrations, Narnia has some in most of the published versions, but that's designed for younger children. But this is definitely more young adult, which is, you know, it's certainly any kid who is a strong reader from the age of, I would say, about 8 could enjoy it. I did try the book on middle school kids as part of my sort of outreach before publishing it to get some feedback, which was very useful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting what the point of view of a reader who is actually your target audience from sort of 11 to 13 likes about the book. And that was fascinating.
Well, how did you go about doing that?
My girlfriend, Tina Nelson, is a teacher at the middle school. She teaches GOL and language arts, so she knew kids who are always hungry for books, you know, can't be kept in books because they'll read, you know, a lot. And so she just asked them if they would like to read a book that hadn't been published. And there were several of them who were quite fascinated by that idea, and the idea that their feedback could actually contribute to the book being changed before it was published, which it
I'll
did.
Bet.
You know,
I'll bet.
They were picking up anything from typos to, you know, plot ideas, or I don't understand this, or, you know, things that had to be clarified.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, it's hard to think of exactly what it was, but they were very practical things. Like, you know, sometimes they were continuity issues, like, you know, this person seems to have got back from this place too quickly, or, you know, which day was this? I'm not quite sure when this happened, or this name's too close to this name. I think you ought to change it. It's confusing.
Oh.
You know, very good feedback, very useful feedback. And oftentimes when you've written something, you're so close to it that, you know, the difference between characters is obvious to you, and it's not necessarily obvious to somebody else, and that you can get the names confused. You know, if I was advising Tolkien, for example, on Lord of the Rings, there are a lot of names which are really very similar, which you might have thought of making slightly different, but he almost made a virtue out of making them similar. Just to confuse, but he found that necessary.
Yeah, he didn't. I don't think making it easy to read was one of his goals.
Probably not. And, you know, a lot of the best books ever written for kids have been ones that have not attempted a compromise. A really good example being Beatrix Potter with the Peter Rabbit books, which are very simple, but the vocabulary is, you know, one of the first things you learn if you read the Tale of Peter Rabbit is that lettuce is soporific. You know, most kids would have to look that word up or be told what it meant. But I always liked the fact that she didn't kind of dumb it down for young readers, because how do young readers learn new words if you don't give them any? So, I mean, I was sort of conscious for the audience I was writing for, but, you know, I didn't make any great attempt to, you know, dumb the vocabulary down at all.
Well, there were several occasions in the book where I was really delighted with kind of metaphors or turns of phrase that you, original turns of phrase that you used. Because the book, for the most part, is, like you said, it's action, suspense, you know, and so it's fairly plot-driven.
Yes.
And character-driven.
Yeah.
But every now and then, there's just, like, this really delightful language in there, too. So you get that in as well.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy. I mean, to my mind, that's an important part of it, because it's got to be attractive, not just a sort of series of events, otherwise it just gets too thin. And you can read something, you know, you can forgive a lot of issues with plot if the characters are interesting. It's more difficult to do it the other way around. If the characters are wooden, then the plot doesn't carry as much. So
that is true.
Yeah, the characters.
Can you tell us about the characters a little bit?
Yes. So I mentioned that there are two groups, one of whom sort of support the dragons and try to look after them, and also protect the secrecy, which the dragons themselves think is necessary, and the others who believe basically that they're demonic and that should be destroyed. So the heroes of the story basically are based around the Owen family. David Owen is the father, and his son Griff, who's 15, and then he has three close friends, some twins, his girlfriend Rihanna, and her somewhat troubled twin brother Rhys, and then a very smart but also very ambitious kid called Jude. And a lot of the story is about when they become aware of the dragons, which sort of way they're drawn. Are they drawn to protecting them and doing what the dragons want? Or are they drawn more to the order and the Order of St. George, which is very seductive, because it has a lot of sort of power and structure and ritual and organization, which is like any secret society. Mm-hmm. You know, it has that whole seductive quality to it. And so you've also got other members of the protectors who are somewhat secondary figures, but they all have a part to play in the story. Then you've got the order themselves. You've got Nolan Gage, who's the head of the order, whose title is the Fae, who's a pretty uncompromisingly ambitious and evil character, and his sidekick, the Questioner, who is a very sinister character, and several people have told me they think he's the most sinister character in the book. And there's very all of those people on the order are somewhat unpleasant in different and subtle ways. And then, of course, the dragons themselves, who aren't all good. You know, they're not all good. No, there's one classic traitor amongst the dragons who, in return for gold, tries to betray the other dragons who he feels let him down, part of the story. But so you've got plenty of different characters. There's plenty of mix to the story, but... You look like you had a question, Monica.
No, well, what I was doing, did you happen to bring the book with you?
I didn't, no.
Because I know and I forgot to bring my Kindle, which I was going to bring, and I wanted you to read from it. So I was going to see if I could download it from my Kindle page on Amazon.
There will be a sample on Amazon, I think.
Okay. I might be able to actually get the whole book on here because I bought it on my Kindle, and I have Kindle for PC set up as well.
Right. But certainly anyone who is thinking of buying the book on Kindle, they have programmed into it a sample, which is the first 10 pages or something. So anyone that was wondering whether they wanted to buy it could always
read from that.
Get it up.
Okay,
there.
Let me see if I can do that.
Tell us how you go about getting it on Kindle.
Well, that's a very, very good question, and it's not simple. I wrote it in Word, and then I thought, well, you either give it to them in Word or you give it to them in PDF, but no, it's not that simple. And also, there were a lot of formatting problems in trying to get it in a form that Kindle would accept. And in the end, I hired a consultant who was not that expensive. He cost about $80. And funnily enough, was in England. And he specializes in taking books for both Kindle and Nook. And the book is on both now. And taking a Word document and formatting it so it will come up as you want it on Kindle. Because there are all kinds of things that happen when you're trying to upload an e-book. That often can be very frustrating with formatting, not looking as you want it, with the chapter headings, for example, being justified to the left instead of being centered, or there being weird stuff about the spacing between lines. One of the weird things about Kindle, if listeners have never used one, is it doesn't have any page numbers. And the reason it doesn't is because you can alter the size of the text. You know, if you want to read it with large font, you can, particularly if your vision's not too good, or you can reduce the font, and obviously then you can't have page numbers because that's going to affect what page it's at.
Right.
And so that was somewhat unusual. So if you ever read a Kindle book or you ask someone who has a Kindle, oh, how far are you into the book? They'll say, I'm 32%, because that's the only way you can make sense out of where you are in the book.
Yeah.
I like it too.
Well, now I'm used to the idea. It seems perfectly sensible and actually in a way more useful than knowing what page number you're on, which, unless you know how long the book is, doesn't mean anything.
Right.
So it's not simple. And I would really suggest, unless you're extremely tech savvy, that the cheapest and most stress-free way to do it is to get someone to do it for you. And as I say, I found someone on the net who just does it. I wouldn't say they do it for a living, but they do it all the time. And they did it in about a week, and it was very satisfying because it looked exactly the way I wanted it to. And mm-hmm. after you've written a book over 10 years, you really want it to be right.
Oh, of course.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Andrew Edlin, the author of Inaccessible Dragon Retreat, published in July on Kindle and Nook.
Right. And you can also download it from Kindle onto a PC. You don't actually have to have or an iPhone or an iPad or any of those kinds of
it's kind
platform.
Of, yeah, I was going to say it's cross-platform nowadays.
Yeah. And
it's amazing.
And I certainly know people who've read it on their iPhone, which would be something of a trick for me, but
I was
going
to say they must be under 50.
People, oh, definitely. People, you know, people can do that. And again, it's a question of size of font, you know.
Right.
So
did you actually work on this book for 10 years?
Yeah, on and off. I mean, I was.
What was the process like?
I think most people that write a book would relate to this. There are times when you're spending a lot of time on it and you're writing, you know, 10 pages a day or something. You know, you're really, you've got a chunk that's coming very easily, and then you have to stop and think what comes next. And, you know,
there's parts you slog through.
Yeah, there are. And then, you know, there's, for me at least, the endless process of revision. And quite often, if I hadn't come to the book for a while, I'd have to reread maybe the whole thing or at least two or three chapters before I could get to the point of having to being able to write new stuff, because I'd have to be reminded exactly where I was and, you know, who was in the room and that kind of thing. And then I get involved in the story and I'd start editing the bits that had already been written, and I wouldn't actually ever get to writing anything new. And that happened a lot of the time. I think the one advantage of that is when you write a book over a really long period of time like that, it's a better book. Mm. Because you've really edited it and gone over it and checked it, and it's more coherent and it's more thought out. I had a little bit of an advantage with that because the one-man play I'd written, Churchill, I'd originally, you know, written between sort of 1994 and first produced in 97. And so I knew the value of going back and revising and editing and sifting and cutting and replacing something over a long period of time. And so I knew that that was the wise thing to do with the book as well. And so it's proved, you know, because it's tight.
It is, and it has quite an involved plot with a lot of twists and turns. Did that occur as you wrote, or did you know where you were going? Did you know the beginning and the end, but you weren't sure how you were getting there? Or how did the plot develop for you?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. I knew bits of what was going to happen, but by and large, and I knew roughly where it was going at the end, although I did write three different endings and four different beginnings. But I knew roughly where we were going. But there was definitely some changes along the way. I mean, books are interesting things. When I first started to write the book, David Owen's son, Griff, was definitely the central character, you know. And as somebody pointed out to me, you know, some of his friends became actually, in a sense, more interesting characters and a little bit more central. Not that I mind that. I think a good book evolves on its own, you know. Mm-hmm. Very, very few authors really know in detail exactly how their characters are going to evolve and how much of a place they're going to take and have it really planned out. In that case, J.K. Rowling is definitely the exception rather than the rule. She had much more of an idea how even, you know, smaller characters were going to come out at the end. For me, I was definitely on the other end of the spectrum. It was just the characters were evolving, and I just had a very general idea how it was going to happen. But it's remarkable when you create something like that, it develops a life of its own. It should do.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely did in my case.
Did you know which characters were going to die?
Well, not many do, actually, really, all things considered. But I did know some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you didn't let yourself get as attached to them, perhaps?
It's not that. I mean, if you're going to have characters that die, there's got to be some attachment to them. Otherwise, they're not particularly interesting.
Right.
I think that's one of the mistakes that beginning writers, or particularly young writers, make, is not being willing to let important or loved characters go. And they do that when they're playing chess, too. You know, they try not to lose any of their pieces because they like them too much. And, you know, one of the essences of good chess is sacrificing in order to win the game. Uh-huh. And I think writing is sometimes a little bit like that, too. I mean, one of the most powerful things about, again, Harry Potter is the obvious example. You know, when Dumbledore dies, and if you didn't know that he died, anyone listening, I'm sorry if I just spoiled that. But,
if you didn't know, you've been in a closet.
It's sort of inevitable and yet still shocking, and that's really what you want to have when you sacrifice a character like that.
Yeah.
There are definitely some, you know, characters that, and in the context of the book, I think it's shocking because the book is fairly gentle. I mean, we're not talking about mayhem. I mean, young adult can sometimes even put people off thinking, oh, well, it's going to be, you know, lots of slashing and blood and gore and so forth, and the book isn't like that. The book, in a sense, is slightly old-fashioned, and that's partly because it's set in 61 and partly probably me, I would say.
No, there is some violence, but yeah. It's not graphic violence. It's,
It's a slightly old-fashioned way of
right, of
looking at it.
Right, and there is some romance, which is also very
a little romance amongst the kids and a little amongst the dragons.
Yes, yeah,
which is nice, I think.
Yeah.
But essentially, you know, it's funny because when again another thing you do when you put it up on Kindle or something like that, you really get a fairly limited choice of what genre you're going to put it into. You know, you're staring down the... and I don't think Nook, weirdly enough, even has a young adult as such. So, you know, action-adventure is really what it is. You know, I mean, yes, it has a fantasy element. How can it not with dragons? But it's essentially an action-adventure story. That almost came as a shock to me. I thought, well, yeah, I guess that is what it is. You know, but that's... That's right. So it's a good yarn. It's a book that hopefully people, when they start reading it, they don't really want to put it down because the action drives through.
At what point did you feel you had a complete first draft? Did that take years?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I didn't get to the end of it, to the final part, with the first ending, as it were, until. Last year. And then I started to submit that to people to read. Some of the feedbacks said, well, for a start, it would require a second book. And some of the feedback was, you know, this is either a little confusing, or it's a little bit of a letdown, or, you know, the last part of the book needs to be a little bit more explanatory. And in the end, I made the book one book. I mean, it's certainly there could be a sequel quite easily, but it's complete in itself. And once I had that, I knew basically I had the thing correct. Then it was just a question of tidying it up and and correcting things.
And then you were doing the revisions, and I know people can spend another 10 years sometimes doing that. How did you know when you had done enough?
That's a beautiful question, too. I mean, the old adage, don't get it right, get it written, is the first thing. Because, you know, you see this particularly in photographers, people that go out with about 200 weight of equipment, particularly in the older days, of meters and special lenses and things. And it's never quite right. So they never take a photograph. They're outside and they're sort of posing and nearly taking a photograph for 4 hours. And they come home and they haven't taken one shot. And if you're not careful, you can get into that with a book too, that it's never quite right and it's just never finished.
Right.
So at a certain point, you have to be a bit brutal with yourself and say, it may not be perfect, but at this point, that's it. It's done.
It's good enough to meet the world.
It's good enough to meet the world and, you know, to get the feedback. And, you know, one of the beauties of publishing on Kindle is, you know, you can always change it down the road if it goes into another format. Who knows? But there is a certain point where you just feel, yeah, it's fine. You're just really doing tiny, tiny, tiny things. Mm. And at that point, you know, it's ready. And it's a luxury, really, to have to take the time to do that.
Well, Andrew, I do have the preview up here from Amazon, if you'd care to come over on this side and read.
I can do that.
Yeah.
Do I just come around to where you are?
Yeah, let me, there we go.
Yes. All right, yeah, I'll come
on
around.
Over. And I'll see. We'll just get a little music on while we're making this switch. Okay, we're back with Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Andrew Edlin, author of Inaccessible Dragon Retreat. Andrew is going to read the first part of this book for us today.
Yes, we're going to read the beginning of Chapter 1, which is the part that you can read for free as a sample on Amazon. Chapter 1. Professor Robert Barrow peered down over the lectern, beaming proudly at the 22 students who had signed up for his 1961 summer series of lectures on cryptic creatures of myth and legend at the London School of Anthropology. Dragons, unicorns, mermaids, yeti, Sasquatch, sea monsters, he recited in his melodious Welsh accent, clicking his way through slides of fanciful paintings, ending with a notorious grainy black-and-white photograph of a Scottish loch. All are creatures that we are perfectly familiar with. Nonetheless, science says they do not exist. Yet every year we find new fossil remains of dinosaurs whose many species are more fantastic and bizarre than any of the above. In the turtle, the crocodile, and the shark, we already have survivors from Mesozoic waters. He waved his pointer at the projected image of the Loch Ness monster's graceful neck. Why not a plesiosaur? Professor Barrow clutched the lapels of his gown and nodded at a scrawny youth with his hand up, who was scarcely restraining a laugh. But, Professor, everyone knows that those other creatures are just stories. Although I'm not sure about the yeti, he said significantly, looking across the row of seats at a long-haired and bearded fellow student. There was a ripple of laughter. I prefer not to begin any statement with the words, "Everybody knows, Mr. Tepper," observed Barrow indulgently. Everybody once knew the earth was flat and that the sun revolved around it. There was more good-natured laughter. But dragons, unicorns, persisted Tepper. I am unconvinced about the existence of unicorns, disagreeing with Sebastian in Shakespeare's The Tempest, conceded Professor Barrow pedantically, steepling his bony hands together either side of his nose. He smiled. Then his face suddenly became grave, and his eyes took on a distant look. But I have seen a dragon. There was another ripple of laughter. Was old Barrow referring to the formidable Professor Maud Astell? The laughter died suddenly, as if switched off, as the students realized the professor was serious. So the rumors were true, thought Tepper. Old Barrow really is a nutcase. This should be fun. I saw the last dragon leave Wales. I was 8 years old. The professor sighed, closing his eyes, his thin old hands grasping the sloped sides of the lectern, focusing on a day long ago. Nobody moved. It was the autumn of 1889. I was out at sea, fishing in a small boat with my grandfather off the Pembroke coast by St. David's Head. It was just after dawn. I saw him first, above the cliffs, heading south out to sea. A rusty red he was, with patches of black on the belly, the wings swept back, magnificent, the tail straight but with triangular ridges or spines. I thought I was hallucinating. The dragon seemed to flicker in and out of my sight, although there was not a cloud in the sky. The Welshman drew in another breath, remembering. And the eyes. Even 90 feet above us I could see his eyes, golden yellow with a slit of black. Now all the old stories say never to look into a dragon's eyes, but I could not help it. There is intelligence and vast age and wisdom, but also an imperious ancient power, ruthless, unyielding, single-minded, alien. My grandfather, with a fishing net in his hand, saw the shadow over the water before he saw the creature himself. When he looked up, his eyes shone with pleasure and concern at the same time. "Get down in the bottom of the boat and stay down, Robbie boy," he told me. Oh, the dragon saw us clear enough, and suddenly glided without beating his wings. For a long 2 seconds I thought he would drop on us. The full glare of those terrible eyes was on us, and I could clearly see tongues of flame and smoke around the flared nostrils. Then there was a sound of a rifle shot. He beat his wings, and in less than a minute he was gone out to sea over the top of Goronwy's rock. We sat in the boat until he had gone, speechless. My grandfather told me he had seen the very same dragon when he was 15, climbing Snowdon and lost in a fog. The pattern of scales, black on red, was unmistakable. He had always dreamed of seeing him again. He told me to tell nobody what we had seen that morning, but we were not the only witnesses. Who had fired that shot? We noticed a reflective flash on the cliff, and there was a man with a great black beard sitting on a horse. He was wearing safari clothes, including a pith helmet. The man near the ruined church, with a binocular and the reins in one hand and a rifle in the other. My grandfather knew that man. I'll say no name, but grandfather didn't like him. He was a collector from London, looking for rare eggs, fossils, etc., always nosy, asking questions, checking rumours and stories of strange things. The man was hunting that dragon, but he missed him. I'm glad he missed, and I'm glad to think that somewhere that old dragon found refuge and still lives. There was a long silence. The students had been frozen silent and motionless, listening to Professor Barrow's extraordinary account. Then Tepper burst out. "You're joking, Professor, right? You were very young. You fell asleep in the boat. You were dreaming. You don't expect us to believe all that, do you?" The professor smiled a little sadly. "No, Mr. Tepper, I do not expect you to believe it. However, it is interesting that you do not. After all, I have given you a first-hand witness account. All you have on the skeptic side is that everybody knows." "Professor, I think you are playing a game with us, said a pretty young student with short blonde hair. "This is one of those American truth games, isn't it?" The professor smiled. "No, Miss Sands, not a game, although challenging blind prejudice has its moments of sport." Even on the first day of class, and aged 80, Professor Barrow knew every student by name. "How do you know the dragon was male, and that it was the last to leave Wales?" asked a severe-looking young woman with horn-rimmed spectacles. Bobby Barrow looked at her with respect and smiled in appreciation. "That's both very good questions, Miss Avery. My instinct, I suppose." Tepper scowled and snorted, without any pretense of politeness this time. "Well, I think you're crazy, sir, and I can't believe they let you teach this nonsense here. You'll be telling us about fairies next." Professor Barrow rather theatrically consulted his notes, tipping his rimless spectacles onto the end of his nose. "Or next week, in fact, Mr. Tepper. Leprechauns, fairies, elves, sprites, goblins, oh, and trolls, if we have time." The laughter returned, but with an edge of uneasiness now. Would the professor tell them his grandmother had been eaten by a troll? The professor raised a wrinkled hand for silence. His voice no longer quavered, but became stronger and more authoritative. "Ladies and gentlemen, have you never considered how strange it is that the legends of dragons in almost every culture, separated by thousands of miles in as many years, are so similar? How could this come about?
Apply your objective reasoning skills as you have been taught, without prejudice. The details of their physiognomy, wings, spines, claws, etc., their size, their wisdom, their hoarding gold and other precious shiny objects, their breathing fire, the mesmeric power of their eyes. In China there are buildings with their corners cut off, as not to obstruct the dragon's way. How do you account for a global legend before global communications, unless there is a common basis in fact? Apply your scientific minds to that. Tepper merely grunted. Many other students looked thoughtful, including one student, a Mr. Morris, who was taking very full notes of what Bobby Barrow said. But his notes were not for a paper. They were a report, to be sent to a post office box belonging to an ancient order, the Most Honorable Order of St. George. Elizabeth Avery came up to Professor Barrow at the end of the lecture as he was gathering his notes together. This close to him, she took off her glasses, as if to wring the truth from the professor with her very intelligent brown eyes. Her accent was a soft but insistent West Country burr. "You knew for certain that he was male, and he was not the last dragon in Wales. You're not the sort of man to say that on a hunch, Professor. I believe your story, but I don't think you're telling us anything like all of it. How much more do you know about dragons?" Bobby Barrow smiled at the perceptive young student. She noticed how the friendly, sweet smile made him look almost young, smoothing away many lines. Even so, it was a smile full of secrets. She was prepared to be frustrated when he said, "Answer me two questions, Elizabeth Grace Avery, age 19, of Minehead, Somerset. Can you keep a secret?" His quiet but firm voice said it was not a light question, and she knew it. "Yes." Bobby seemed to consider, then he nodded. "Come to tea at 4 o'clock. Professor, what is the second question?" "Ah, yes. The second question. Tea. Do you prefer Ceylon or Oolong?"
That was Andrew Edlin reading from Inaccessible Dragon Retreat, which is available on Amazon.com. And how do you get it for the Nook? It's on Barnes & Noble?
Yeah,
Barnes & Noble. And so if that didn't pique your interest, I don't know what would. Are you going to do a book on tape?
You know, I've thought about that. That's also quite an operation. But yes, it's something I would like to do. And also, I'm trying to get there is a program within Amazon in which you can get hard copies. But it doesn't seem to work very well. I've put in several phone calls and not got calls back. So that's something else. But a book on tape would be very nice, or a book on CD, yes, and in some sort of audio form.
Well, we've talked to a number of writers over the years who have used print on demand.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
Not through Amazon necessarily. There's Lightning Source is the main. They usually go through Lightning Source to Amazon. That's certainly a
That's definitely something to pursue, and then whether I probably want to read it myself just to get all the pronunciations and so forth right. But
oh yes,
it takes a little while.
Yeah,
not that long actually.
Well, I think reading the book yourself would really make it great.
It's something I would like to do.
Do you have anything planned to promote the book? Any promotions? Any marketing?
At the moment, I'm just a little short of time, so I'm just sort of waiting to see what kind of reaction it gets. We have, Holly and I, Holly's done the work, sent it out to various people who will read books and give a review, and there's a lot of people online who will do that. So that could be interesting, and that will probably kick something up. But, you know, a lot of these things seem to be serendipitous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, old-fashioned publishing, I wouldn't say it's dead, but it's certainly a shadow of its former self.
Yes, for sure.
So, you know, the idea of printing out copies and sending them to publishing houses, which is something I have done in the past with previous books that I've written, I don't think I'm going to be doing that anymore. Mm. There doesn't seem to be much of a future in it. So I'm kind of expecting that eventually you know, for it to become more widely known, someone's going to pick it up online and like it, and it'll go from there. And that's normally what seems to happen when you hear stories of things online. They suddenly go viral and become very popular.
You talked about other books you've written. What other books have you written, and had you published any of them?
No. I mean, most of them were somewhat juvenilia, you know, sort of early books, short stories. I do actually make a list of them right at the end of the book, if anyone's curious. But, you know, as I say, I've been writing all my life pretty much. I think the first really terrible book I wrote was at about the age of 8. And it's a process, you know. It really is. It's a process of just practice. I don't think there's probably anything in the world that takes quite as much practice as writing a decent book. I don't know that there's anyone that can just write a book without previous experience of writing. It's not something you can.
So your past books have all been fiction?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I mean, in the natural course of work. And what I do involved with theatre and so forth, I end up writing quite a lot of, you know, reviews and non-fiction pieces, but not
right.
Non-fiction books.
And are there any of those previous books that you're going back to now, you know, with greater experience, that you would go back to make?
It's just possible, but it's not very likely.
Yeah. So are you working on something new?
The things I'm working on at the moment are mostly, actually, I'm thinking of writing a musical and another play.
That's your ringtone.
That's a ringtone. Yes.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Writing a musical and a play. I'm not actually. I did start another novel not that long ago. Which I could possibly pick up. I mean, I normally have 5 or 6 creative projects on the back burner, and now Inaccessible is finally finished, I can move something onto the front burner. Mm-hmm. And it's most likely going to be about a 1-hour play, which is a middle school doing a version of Hamlet that goes really severely wrong.
Ooh. Oh, sounds interesting.
So it's a comedy. It's yeah. called. It's actually called Omelet.
Oh, great.
And it's based on an experience I had seeing a play, a version of Hamlet done by an English public school, which was really old school, literally, and had no girls. So all of the parts were played by boys. And there kept being these most appalling tech problems. Things just going wrong and people snagging their costumes as they walked on stage, and it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. So I thought, in a mild way, I might want to try and recreate that. So that's probably my next writing.
It wasn't on purpose. Those.
Oh, not at all. That's what made it so funny. And I've also been working. I've probably done the most research on doing a one-man play about Beethoven. I've done a lot of research on that and got some ideas.
Saw Churchill, and that was really wonderful. So
looking forward
to this.
That's certainly my signature piece. But
thank you for joining us today on Writers' Voices, Andrew. We're actually out of time, believe it or not.
My pleasure.
And
it was great.
I can't wait to read the end of the book. I'm almost there. I think I'm 80%.
So, oh, well, that's good.
Yep.
Yeah, there's quite a lot happens in the last 20%.
And, Mom, you have some parting words of wisdom for us today?
I do. This is from Mark Twain. A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes.
There you go.
And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Bye, Andrew.
Bye-bye.